Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Health Report and Explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back for another As It Is program. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We are here to help you learn and improve your American English and hear about important events that are happening in our world. Today, we will begin with more information about the crash of an airplane in Ukraine. The United Nations says a war crime may have been committed. This is a very serious charge, and we will provide you with details. Then we will travel to New York City. A number of Catholic churches may be about to close. We will tell you why and what some people are saying about it. Let's get started. Here is part one. A United Nations official says the shooting down of a Malaysian airplane over eastern Ukraine may be judged a war crime. Navi Pillay is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. On Monday, she called for an independent investigation to establish the events that led to the incident. In addition, her office released a report on the human rights situation in Ukraine. Bob Doty has more.
Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down with a surface-to-air missile earlier this month. The plane crashed in territory controlled by pro-Russian separatists. Rupert Colville is a spokesman for Navi Pillay. He says no one believes the crash was an accident. He says it is widely accepted that the plane was shot down.
The proof about who exactly is not there yet, and that's why you need the full investigation. But if this plane was shot down, as most people seem to think, then obviously the question of whether this is a war crime would come up. It contained around 300 civilians, and they were killed.
The Human Rights Chief's Office released a report on human rights in Ukraine. The report notes a sharp increase in the number of human rights violations in eastern Ukraine between June 8th and July 15th. It describes a serious worsening of the situation in areas controlled by armed groups. The report says armed groups continue to capture, detain, torture, and execute people. It says the groups take such actions to frighten and exercise power over the local population. Johnny Magazzini is the chief of the Americas, Europe, and Central Asia branch at the UN Human Rights Office. He says armed groups have kidnapped or detained more than 800 people in the Donetsk and Luhansk areas since the middle of April. He says these individuals are held until someone pays for their release. He says they may also be exchanged for rebels held by the central government in Kiev. And he says the detainees also are used to build defenses for the armed groups or to fight government forces.
The report also described the total breakdown of law and order and the reign of fear and terror that exists in these areas under the control of the armed groups. The report also notes the professionalization of the armed groups with increasing well-organized and well-equipped militarily, led both politically and militarily by citizens of the Russian Federation. There are also instances referred to in the report in which a military tribunal has been convicting people to death.
The UN report says at least 1,129 people have been killed and more than 3,400 wounded in Ukraine since April. And it says more than 100,000 have been displaced within the country. The report says the UN Human Rights Office is worried about the increase in the number of heavy weapons in civilian areas. These weapons include artillery, tanks, rockets, and missiles. It says this is resulting in greater loss of life and severe damage to buildings, bridges, and other infrastructure. And it says the infrastructure will be extremely costly to repair once the fighting ends. The UN Human Rights Office also says the situation in Crimea continues to worsen. Russia took control of Crimea in March. The report also noted an increase in harassment of and discrimination against Ukrainian nationals, Crimean Tatars, religious minorities, and activists. I'm Bob Doty.
Leaders of the Roman Catholic Church in New York may enact a plan to combine or close some churches in New York City. Officials of the Archdiocese, or governing organization, say changing populations, limited resources, and fewer priests are among the reasons. Some Catholics express deep regret about the proposed plan. They fear their churches will close. They worry special services will close. The Church of the Holy Innocents in central Manhattan is an example. It is the only area church that provides the Catholic service called Mass in Latin every weekday. Many travel across New York to attend. Edward Hawkins makes the trip, although he is disabled.
The Mass takes us to a different place. We concentrate at the Mass. It requires a great concentration. It lifts us up. It brings us to a different level, removes us from the world.
But the Church of the Innocents and other Manhattan churches are at risk of possibly being closed or combined. A program called Making All Things New by the Archdiocese of New York is examining the membership, ministry, and finances of the churches it governs. Catholics in Manhattan once made up 25% of the archdiocese's population, but now they provide only 12%. The possible closing of Holy Innocents signals a larger problem to Thomas Basile. He has been attending the church since he was a child.
And it seems to me almost like someone intentionally dismantling the Catholic patrimony of this city. This is basically a Catholic city with a Catholic history.
Joseph Zwilling serves as communications director for the Archdiocese.
Any kind of change is always difficult. We understand that it's difficult, especially for the people in their parishes who love their churches, who love the way things are, and they don't want to see any change. And we understand that. But we also realize that if the church is going to continue to effectively meet the needs of the people, it has to meet the needs of the people as they exist today.
Critics like Mr. Hawking say the churches may be closing for financial reasons.
The financial condition of the archdiocese somehow may be corrupting decisions to make decisions to sell churches.
Mr. Zwilling denied that claim. He said the archdiocese spends $30 to $40 million a year to help churches that cannot pay their debts, and he said that could not continue. The communications director said a church will be sold only when no other choice is available, and he said even when that happens, the money will be used for church members. Archbishop Timothy Dolan of New York is expected to announce a decision in the coming weeks. Catholics in Manhattan recently demonstrated in the streets. They wanted to show that their churches are still lively and active. Well, you can be sure that the As It Is team is lively and active because we provide you with a way to learn and improve your American English every day. If you are using a computer to hear us, be sure to save and print the words we say
and then download the audio and save it. That way you can practice reading and speaking English anytime you want. And if you are listening to the radio, be sure to write to us and tell us what is the loudest frequency you can hear. Be sure to join us again tomorrow. Learning English is part of the Voice of America. We are coming to you from Washington.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health Report. In the eyes of the United States federal government, marijuana is an illegal drug. But almost half of the U.S. states have made marijuana use legal, or at least a minor crime. People who support legalization of marijuana say some kinds of the plant offer extraordinary help for human health. For example, one kind of medical marijuana is reported to ease effects of epilepsy, a disease of the nervous system. Rachel and Sean Selmeski are happy that their baby girl Maggie can hold up her head. That is a normal mark of growth for a 4-month-old child. But Maggie is 2 years old. Maggie has spent much of her life in the hospital. Shortly after birth, doctors found that Maggie has a rare form of epilepsy. Epilepsy can cause people to suddenly become unconscious. It can also cause violent, uncontrolled movements of the body called seizures. Maggie's kind of epilepsy can cause hundreds of seizures in a single day. Her parents hurried her to the hospital emergency room many times in the first year of her life. Doctors administered treatments and medicines to save her life. But Mr. Zalmeski says these treatments also had other severe effects on his little girl.
They drugged her up. I mean, she would sleep for 20 hours a day. It wouldn't make a noise all day long.
So they turned to a new kind of medical marijuana called Charlotte's Web. Marijuana growers in the U.S. state of Colorado developed the plant. Marijuana is legal in Colorado, but not in Tennessee, where the Zalmeskis lived. Maggie's doctors could not order marijuana as a treatment. So they urged the Zalmeskis to do something extreme, head west. 1 year ago, the family moved to Colorado. They began giving Maggie Charlotte's Web marijuana, mixed with olive oil, 3 times a day. The Zalmeskis say Maggie's condition improved immediately. She could digest food better. She began developing more muscle. And they say she began to smile more. Most parents will do just about anything to help lessen the suffering of their children. About 200 families have moved to Colorado from other parts of the country just to get Charlotte's Web for their epileptic children. The Zalmeskis say they hope that growing interest and knowledge of marijuana's medical value will lead to federal support for more research. And that's the Health Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you. Explorations, a program in special English by the Voice of America. Today, Shirley Griffith and Tony Riggs complete a report about America's second manned space program, Gemini. Its purpose was to bring the United States closer to its goal of landing astronauts on the moon.
To explore the surface of the moon, astronauts must be able to survive outside the protection of their spacecraft. So an astronaut on the flight of Gemini 4, Ed White, took that first frightening step into the unknown. For more than 20 minutes, he floated outside his spacecraft in the emptiness of space. Astronauts on the next flight, Gemini 5, suffered a number of technical problems, but they were able to survive in space for 8 days. Then it was time to launch Gemini 6. Its crew would attempt a move that would be necessary for any landing on the moon. The astronauts would chase another object orbiting Earth, and they would move their spacecraft as close as possible to it. However, the target, a satellite, apparently exploded after it was launched. So America's space agency, NASA, said there was no reason to send up Gemini 6. NASA decided to move ahead with the next flight, Gemini 7.
Then NASA considered yet another plan. It would launch Gemini 7. And if everything was ready, it would launch Gemini 6 a few days later. Gemini 6 would chase and get close to Gemini 7 instead of a satellite. Astronauts Frank Borman and James Lovell were the crew of Gemini 7. They would make the longest, most difficult flight ever. They would spend 14 days in their tiny spacecraft.
Gemini 7 lifted off from Cape Canaveral, Florida, on Friday, December 3, 1965. Workers at the Space Center examined the launch area. There appeared to be no major damage. The workers quickly moved another huge Titan rocket into place. On top of the rocket sat the Gemini 6 spacecraft. NASA announced that Gemini 6 would be launched in the early morning of Sunday, December 12th. The timing would put the two spacecraft in the correct orbit to meet in space. Astronauts Walter Schirra and Thomas Stafford prepared for their flight. They had waited once in a spacecraft that never left the ground. Their first launch had been canceled because the target satellite exploded. This time, they hoped, things would be different.
On that Sunday morning, Schirra and Stafford were again in their tiny Gemini 6 spacecraft atop the Titan rocket. Borman and Lovell, in Gemini 7, speeded across the United States. The countdown at Cape Canaveral reached zero as Gemini 7 passed overhead. Frank Borman's disappointed words from space told the story. "I saw ignition, then shut down." For some reason, the Titan rocket engines had fired as planned, but then they shut themselves off 1 second later. For several tense minutes, the astronauts of Gemini 6 were sitting on top of a highly explosive mass of rocket fuel. Shira waited with his hand on a special device. If he pulled it, he and Stafford would get away safely. If he did not pull it and the rocket exploded, they would be killed. With nerves of steel, the astronauts waited. The rocket did not explode.
Once again, Shira and Stafford climbed out of Gemini 6. Borman and Lovell continued to circle the Earth. Soon, the public heard the report. A tiny part at the bottom of the rocket had fallen out too early. That tiny part sent a signal to computers that the launch had taken place. The computers immediately shut off the rocket engines. Space agency officials decided to try one more time. They set the launch for 3 days later. It would be the last chance for Gemini 6 to attempt to meet with Gemini 7 in space. If this attempt failed, the United States would suffer a serious delay in its goal to land astronauts on the moon. Borman and Lovell continued to circle the Earth day after day as workers hurried to meet the new launch date. They were almost 300 kilometers high. They were moving at 28,000 kilometers an hour.
December 15th, 1965. This was it. What could be an impossible effort in the history of spaceflight was ready to lift off on its final chance for success. For the third time, Walter Shira and Thomas Stafford put on their space clothing. They took their places in the Gemini 6 spacecraft. The countdown reached zero just as Frank Borman and James Lovell in Gemini 7 passed overhead. This time, with a thundering roar, Gemini 6 rose into the air. As it headed into space, a radio announcer said, "This whole nation pushed that one up."
Now there were four Americans in space. Gemini 6 followed Gemini 7, but in a lower orbit that moved the two spacecraft closer together. Flight controllers on the ground held their breath. Success was near, yet failure was still very possible. The spacecraft were almost 2,000 kilometers apart. They needed to get within 600 meters of each other. Only then would space agency officials consider the project a complete success.
Time passed quickly as Shira moved Gemini 6 closer and closer to its target. Gemini 6 was now 8 kilometers behind and 24 kilometers below Gemini 7. Shira fired a rocket exactly long enough to put his spacecraft in the same orbit. Then, radar on each spacecraft noted the other spacecraft. Happily, Shira sent a radio message to Gemini 7. "We'll be up shortly," he said. A few minutes later, the astronauts were able to see each other's spacecraft. Success seemed within reach. Only 6.5 kilometers separated them. The two spacecraft continued to float together far out in space.
They moved closer and closer together as they flew across the Indian Ocean. It was about 6 hours since the launch of Gemini 6. For a while, there was no communication from space to Earth. The spacecraft were too far from any ground station to send clear messages. Finally, the voice of Thomas Stafford came through the silence of space. "We are 36 meters apart and sitting." 36 meters! That was far better than the 600 meters space agency officials would have considered a complete success. In fact, the two spacecraft almost touched each other before they separated. Space agency officials now knew that it was possible to join two orbiting spacecraft. The crew on Gemini 6 had made the operation seem easy.
As the American astronauts continued to float through space, they inspected each other and each other's spacecraft. Frank Borman noted happily that after 12 lonely days in space, he and James Lovell finally had company for one night. The next day, Schirrer and Stafford completed their flight. Gemini 6 landed in the Atlantic Ocean within 20 kilometers of the rescue ship. Gemini 7 continued to speed on.
On December 18th, ground controllers asked Borman and Lovell if they were ready to come home. "Ready, ready," the astronauts answered. Gemini 7 landed as perfectly as Gemini 6. Astronauts Borman and Lovell had been in space more than 330 hours. They had traveled almost 8,500,000 kilometers.
The flights of Gemini 6 and Gemini 7 greatly increased hope that Americans soon would be able to land on the moon. Schirrer and Stafford proved that spaceships could link up while in orbit. Borman and Lovell proved that humans could survive in space for the time needed to get to the moon and back. The distance to the moon suddenly seemed shorter.
Five more Gemini flights followed. Other spacecraft joined with other targets in space and landed exactly where planned. Astronauts worked for longer periods of time in the hostile environment of space. The Gemini program had reached all its goals. Now the United States was ready for the next historic jump into space. It would be Project Apollo. Project Apollo would land men on the moon.
This special English program was written by Marilyn Rice Cristiano. Your narrators were Shirley Griffith and Tony Riggs. I'm Doug Johnson. Listen again next week for another Explorations program on The Voice of America.